Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
And on the line now is Cloyd Stagger. Thank you for being here.
Sure, glad to be here.
Ah, Cloyd. So I see now, in your first book, Homicide, A View from Inside the Yellow Tape, that was a great book, and you've got a follow-up coming out here. Seattle's Forgotten Serial Killer, Gary Jean Grant. Wow, and that is true, because most people, if you talk about Seattle and serial killer, that's not the name that'll come up. So
no, I usually think of Ted Bundy or Gary Ridgway, and I'd never really heard of Gary Jean Grant.
Of course, I tell people all the time that 80% of serial killers, nobody in the world's ever heard of them because they're not the big names, right? There are many serial killers out there that kill 3, 4, 5 and are serial killers, but nobody knows them, nobody's ever heard of them. And so that people think every serial killer is a famous person. They're not.
Yeah, and it still makes you wonder why certain people make that list somehow, where it sticks out and they get movies and they get talked about for years and years, while others don't.
Right. A lot of it depends on who their victims are, and also depends on how much, a lot of times serial killers are operating in an area and the people don't even know what's going on. The police might know, but it doesn't get out. Like with Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer, when that was going on, it was a fiasco at first because news cameras would hear that they're doing surveillance somewhere, and they'd film the detectives doing surveillance, and it was just a nightmare. And because, the sheer numbers is one of the problems. But now it's better. It's much better if you're the police to work in quiet when nobody knows. You have to balance out public safety, and you can put out generic, never do this, never do that, but it's a lot easier to work on serial killer cases if nobody knows you're doing it.
And why is that? Is it because of the quacks that come out of the woodwork, or?
Well, that's part of it. Plus, media, it gets to be a frenzy and stuff, and everybody wants all this information, and it just becomes a nightmare. You're dealing with outside, people are calling in and sometimes confessing who didn't do it, which, by the way, happened in this case of Gary Jean Grant. Somebody confessed to two of the murders and was actually charged with them. Phoning in tips that have nothing to do with the case. If somebody really knows about the case, they'll call in, and they're going to call in. When you get calls when it's not a big public case, that's the ones you have to listen to because they don't know it's a big public case. Sometimes people, they know about the individual murders, but they don't know about the ties between them. And sometimes that's a good thing for the police.
Why do you think so many quacks do call in fake stuff and give you bad leads, you know?
Well, they're not all quacks. Some people are honestly trying to do the right thing, and they don't know if it's good information or not, and neither do you when you first get it. But any major, you know, I've worked a lot of really high-profile cases in my career where big media cases, and literally the tips come in the thousands, right? Thousands of tips, and they have to be gone through. And in that, of those thousands, you might find five or six that actually have anything to do with the case. And the people calling in aren't crackpots. They're just people that think they might know something, and they're trying to do the right thing. And, you know, if you're in that situation, if you're not sure, it's better to call and have it not be involved than not to call and have it be the one we're looking for, right? So yeah. I'm not discouraging people from calling in when they think they know something about a case. But it's, you know, in a big, high-profile media case, you know, we have to assign staff of people just to go through the tips and divide them into categories where they can be worked and, you know, separate it out. A lot of the tips you get is nothing you can do about it. You know, I was riding the bus, I saw a guy look like that on the sidewalk. Well, yeah. Great. Okay, thanks. There's nothing we can do with that. But sometimes, you know, hey, a big case I had a few years ago where a big media chase. A person calls in, and we did a car description, and we put it out, and the person calls in and says, you know, this neighbor of mine has a car just like that, and it's an old piece of crap car. And all of a sudden, he's covered it with a tarp. Ding, 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 guess what? That was the guy, right? Why is he covering this piece of crap car with a tarp and he never did before? Because that information is in the news. That's why he's doing it. So those are the things, sometimes, you know, the little gems like that. But in reality, just the nature of the business, you get overwhelmed with huge amounts of tips. Then tip management is an important part of any big public, you know, high-profile investigation, and you have to assign separate people. You can't have the detectives doing it because they'll be busy reading tips all day long and won't be able to actually investigate the case. There has to be somebody else doing that and screening it, and then just letting the ones that look like they're viable through.
Yeah. Now, Gary Gene Grant, how did you come across him?
Well, here's how I came. This is the weirdest thing because after my first book came out, I got an email from a guy, and he says, what do you know about Gary Grant? He was a serial killer in Renton, which is a suburb of Seattle, back in the 60s and 70s. And I said, I've never heard of Gary Grant. And so he goes, yeah, I tell people about it, nobody seems to remember. So in my current job, we keep track of all these murders that happen. It's the Attorney General's Office Homicide Investigation Tracking System. And we have a big database, and I ran all the things in there, nothing came up. So I called the agencies. We called the agencies that I thought were involved, the Renton Police Department and the King County Sheriff's Office. They both had, like, small little things about it, and nobody knew much about it. Then I called the prosecutor's office and asked, do you have a file on this? Because it was prosecuted. And they go, yeah, I do. We do. And I asked the priority, took it and copied it down, only having no intention of writing a book about it. I was going to put it all in my – we like to keep track of any serial killer we know, whether it happened a long time ago or recently. It's part of our database, so we did that to put in the database. And then about a month later, I get a call from History Press. Hey, you know, we saw you write this other book, and we're looking for true crime historic things that happen in regions. Do you have anything like that you'd like to write about? And I thought, oh, my God, well, yeah, I got Gary Gene Grant. So I sent a proposal in. They said, yeah, write the book. And that's how this all started. It's kind of weird to have a publisher call you and ask you to write a book instead of sending them a submission or a proposal. But they called me, and I said I'd do it, and I wrote the book and sent it through, and it'll be coming out here in January.
That's amazing. What's the rundown on his story? Like, he killed four, I believe?
Yeah, he killed two teenage girls and two six-year-old boys. And he was like 18 when he started this, or at least let me preface that. When we know that he started this, he could have killed others before this or killed them in between, because this is a period of 2 years. 69 to 71 that he was killing these people. He could have killed others that we don't know about, but we know he did these four. But he was kind of a troubled guy. He lived with his parents in a trailer down, like I said, Renton is 11 miles from downtown Seattle. It's, at that time it was a small town of 10,000 people, and there's a Boeing plant there that used to churn out, B-29s during World War II, then went to 707s, and actually the 737 MAX is made there now, or was, and it's blossomed up to over 100,000. But Renton's mainly known because Jimi Hendrix is buried there in a cemetery in town. And so that's when most people have even heard of Renton, because of Hendrix, and people, you know, make the pilgrimage to his grave all the time. But anyway, so this Gary Grant lived in this trailer, and he had, his mother was an alcoholic, and his father had been a police officer, a sheriff's deputy down at this time for a while. I don't know what happened, but at the time this happened, he was a residential security guard. But it was a pretty, I don't want to say violent, but it was a, you know, there was a lot of fighting and throwing things and, you know, weird stuff going on in his apartment, or his trailer, I'm saying, sorry, and he would, just walk around and roam in the woods. And the first one we know about was in December, I think December 15th, 1969. There was a 19-year-old girl named Cheryl Erickson. She went to the Renton Library downtown, which is on the Cedar River. Actually, their library actually spans the Cedar River. And there's this trail that she took walking about, you know, about two-thirds of a mile back to her apartment. And at the time, it was just an old muddy trail, you know, scotch broom along the river. Now, of course, it's a paved and well-lit promenade and really nice walking place. But back then, she's walking down this muddy trail, and she didn't make it home. And the next morning, some people looking to go fishing in the river found a nude body on the side of the river. She'd been stabbed and strangled and raped. And so that was the first one. And first of all, nothing like this usually happens in Renton. At that time especially, I mean, Renton's a bigger town now, busier now. But back then, they might go 2 or 3 years with no murders. So, and when they did have them, they'd be there, smoking gun murder, you know, fighting a bar, domestic violence, where, you know, everybody knows who did it right from the beginning. But they had this girl that was murdered, and they found her dead, and there was a big case, and there were, you know, a lot of, there was evidence there, and there were only like six detectives on the whole police department, and they were all working it, and it went on for a long time, and they just ran out of leads after a while. Then we flash forward ahead to 1970, I believe it was, just outside the city limits of Renton, up on the East Hill, a 17-year-old girl named Joanne Zuloff was home on a Saturday, and she was supposed to go bike riding with a friend. She told her mother, she was kind of restless. She goes, "I'm going to go for a walk before dinner. I'll be right back." And she walked out the front door and didn't come home. And so a neighbor said he saw her walking past his house and saw her take a trail into some woods that are near there. And so he, the next day, the sheriff's office up there came out, and they started to, you know, something was wrong. So they got search and rescue with dogs and everything and started searching that area. And like at midnight on Sunday, they found her nude body in those woods, took off the side of the road. She'd been raped and strangled also. Been hit in the head with something, probably a rock. And so they worked that case, and same thing. They actually knew about the Cheryl Erickson case, the sheriff's detectives, and they called the Renton detectives to kind of, you know, touch base, and yeah, there were some similarities. Actually, you know, in hindsight, there were a lot of similarities, but, you know, on the surface, there were some similarities, but they had nothing to match the two cases together. And then that one kind of faded away. I mean, they were still working it, but it didn't, you know, it was all busy at once and then just kind of dribbled in. And then on a Tuesday, in April of 1971, it was one of those teacher's workshop days where there's no school, and 6-year-old Scott Andrews and his good friend, his neighbor, Bradley Lyons, were also six, were playing in the morning, and they went into some woods near their house. By the way, these three areas are not near each other. I mean, they're generally within two of them are in the city limits of Renton, and one is just outside, but I mean, they're a couple miles apart. They're not the same woods. And they disappeared. And there was a long, you know, big searches that went on for a couple of days. They didn't know what was going on. The Cedar River flows right through there. They were afraid that the boys had fallen in the river. But search and rescue went out a couple of days later and found their nude bodies. One of them had been stabbed and strangled. The other had been strangled, covered with dirt and things like that. Not buried, but just covered with brush. So, of course, needless to say, that really set everybody off. These two little boys are, you know, playing in their yard and went out in these woods that they played in all the time and got murdered. Nobody linked any of these three cases together, right? Nobody linked them. But, in the meantime, a guy walked into Valley General Hospital, which is the hospital in Renton, on the night the boys went missing, and he told the doctor in there that he has psychiatric problems. He always has, and he has this urge to hurt children. And so, you know, they treated him and gave him some Thorazine. And we're talking to him in a couple of days, and they still hadn't found these children. The doctor there is thinking, wow, I mean, this guy came in that night and said he wanted to hurt children, and I wonder if I can talk. He didn't know if he could talk to the doctor-patient privilege. But he called the hospital's lawyers, and there was some exception to battered children or something, so they were able to call the police. And the police zeroed in on this guy. His name was John Chance. And at first, when they talked to him, he didn't seem to know much about the case. But they sent him down to Harborview, which is in downtown Seattle, where there's a big psych ward, and he was there. And a day later, so the detectives went and picked him up. And now all of a sudden, he knew a lot of things about the case and wanted to confess to killing these boys. When I was doing my research, I mean, I was looking at old newspaper articles, and I realized that in the Seattle paper, the police had released all this information to the media. So he just read this in the paper. I'm just regurgitating what he read. That's why you never release all those intimate details to the press, because you want to save that one or two things that only the killer would know. And if you ask him questions about it, and how his response will tell you whether this is the right guy or not. Well, they didn't. They released everything, and then it was a fiasco. They ended up charging this guy with the murders. And ironically, during the time while that was going on, the detectives in Renton went back up to the boys' mercy area with Explorer Search and Rescue people who did shoulder-to-shoulder evidence search. And in the brush, they found a knife. A hunting knife. And so they collected that knife and took it to the crime lab, and it had black electrical tape on the handle. When they undid the electrical tape, it had a name etched into the handle. They figured out who the guy was. He was a guy that was in the Marine Corps, was off to basic training when the murders happened, but was coming back in a couple of days. So when he came back, they started asking about the knife. He said, I sold it to this kid. This guy's a middle schooler in Renton. And so they went to talk to him, and he said, I was in the car with this guy lives in the same trailer court, and I was in his truck, and I left the knife there, and I forgot about it. And I called him and said, hey, you know where my knife is? He goes, oh, my dad found it in the truck, and he has it in his room, and I can't go in his room to get the truck. I mean, get the knife, he'll be mad at me. And he said, well, what's his friend's name? He said, his friend's name's Gary Grant. So the detectives, even though they had somebody already charged with the case, detectives were hinky about the guy that was charged. Both of them later said to me, he was a nut. He would have said anything. He agreed with anything he said. So they went to talk to Grant's dad, thinking he might be the guy, because he supposedly had the knife in his possession, and he was a neighborhood patrol officer. You know, and they thought these boys, if they saw him in his security car, they may have gone with him. That was their train of thought when they went to talk to him. Well, while they're there, Gary dries up. And one of the detectives goes out to talk to him, and he says, why don't you have a seat in my car? And as he does, Gary gets in, and he sees the bottom of his shoe. Well, there was a shoe print left at the scene of the boys in the dirt, and it looked exactly like the bottom of the shoe. So he went in and told his partner, well, we got to get out of here. And they took him downtown, back down to their office. So long story short is I'm going to tell you this whole book, somebody is quiet. They take him to... at that time, they didn't have a polygraph operator themselves. They brought him down to Seattle to the Seattle Police Department polygraph person. And it took a while. This was like at 1 in the afternoon, but the guy was not in the office. So by the time they got him in the office to talk about it, it was, 8-9 o'clock at night. So he goes into the room with the polygraph operator, and the operator, who was just asking him preliminary questions, Gary starts crying. And then he tells the operator he killed the two boys. And so he walks out and tells them he just confessed to killing the boys. Of course, they're like, what? And so they go and they take a long statement from him. They have a recorder. They're trying to record it, but like right when he's getting to the part where he's telling how he did it, the recorder did not record. It failed to record, of course.
Yeah.
They had written notes, and then they wrote out a statement, and then where he confessed to killing the boys, described in detail how he did it and was specific about it. And then the polygraph operator says, let me talk to him again. So he kicks him in the room. And Gary just all of a sudden starts talking about another girl. And he's describing Joanne Zuloff, who, the one who was taking a walk. And he says, I came behind her on the trail. I hit her in the head with a rock. And then I did this. He wouldn't admit sexually assaulting any of them or even taking their clothes off. And he said he didn't remember them. I don't remember the cases, but what he told, this is what I wanted to title the book.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
But the publisher didn't want to do that.
Yeah.
It's when he talked to the psychiatrist later, he said, when I close my eyes, I can see these things happening. So that's what I wanted to be the title of the book, When I Close My Eyes. But they wanted that title because they wanted it to be regional. So I said, okay.
Yeah.
But anyway, but it is mentioned that when I close my eyes, I can see these things happening. He denies any knowledge of it other than that. But he had a clear picture to describe everything. Well, the polygraph operator, who's long since passed, was pretty sharp because he says, tell me about a girl by a river with a shoelace, because her shoelaces were taken off and strangled with it. And he says, did she have dark, long black hair? Was she stabbed in the back? And he started describing the Carol Erickson murder.
Mm.
And so then, of course, you know, they called the King County Sheriff's Detective down, and he talked to this guy till 2 in the morning, confessing all these crimes. And then, but there were a couple of, there's a twist that they had John Chance already charged. They booked this guy for investigation, material witness to murder rather than murder, because they already had somebody arrested, charged with two of them, so they could dismiss those charges. But then there was even more of a wrench thrown into the works when they found out that the attorney came down to talk to Gary at the Renton Police News in this room. They found out later that the captain of detectives had bugged that room to record all the conversations and recorded the conversation between Gary and his attorney, which is a huge no-no.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was like, oh, my God. They found that out after the fact. So now they're scrambling around because the prosecutor's office has to insulate themselves from that. Does that jeopardize this serial killer could walk free because of a mistake like that, right? So there's a lot of legal wrangling, and I was able to talk to the judge in the case who's still around. He's actually the father of the prosecutor I know. And then talked to one of the prosecutors and the son of one of the others who had a lot of memory about it, and how they walked that minefield. And they actually charged that captain with illegal recording of a conversation and ended his career at Renton Police Department. And although he ended up getting, he pled guilty and got probation, but it was, but they decided it took somebody from the Attorney General's office to prosecute that because they didn't want the prosecutor's office to have anything to do with that. Nobody was to listen to that tape, and so they went to trial. And that's basically the gist of the book. So that's the story of it. Obviously, there's much more detail in the book than I just said in the conversation.
What would ever possess that guy to record that conversation?
I just think he was recording all conversations. He didn't set up to record that one. It was already set up. He recorded every conversation in there, and I don't know what it, you know, he's long past, too. But a couple of detectives said, no, I don't know. You know, he was a pretty good guy, but he was kind of a control freak, and I don't know what he was thinking. You know, maybe he didn't know that that was illegal. I mean, in Washington State, it's illegal for anybody. Both people have to, in the room, have to understand that the conversation is being recorded. It's not even good enough that the detective knows. So in the interview rooms, like when I worked for Seattle Police Department, in the interview rooms, which are recorded, I'd walk them in there and say, this is a police station. Everything in here is recorded. You understand that? Yes. Then I'd leave, right? And then 20 minutes later, I'd come back and have the conversation. But on the recording, I said that. You understand we're being recorded, right? Yes. So, because that's the law here. But then to record an attorney in a conversation with us, you know, like if we're in my holding rooms in Seattle, and a guy wants an attorney, and the attorney shows up there, we go in the other room and turn off the recording while the attorney is speaking to him. Because you cannot listen to that. You can't do any of that. That's privileged, you know, and that jeopardizes the entire case. But it's just, like I said, they were able to get it in. It actually got appealed all the way up. They even petitioned the United States Supreme Court, who declined to accept the petition in this case. And Gary Jean Grant is still alive, and he's been 50 years in prison almost. He's in, or actually 48 years in prison, 50 years since the first murder. He's over in Walla Walla Penitentiary, where he's been since he was 19 years old or 20 years old. So
why do you think
that's the story of the book?
Why do you think he went from two girls to two boys, young boys?
I just think I don't know. You know, he said, I can't believe I did it. I like boys. But I think it was just his opportunity. Later on, he said, oh, when I saw those boys, I thought of every boy that's ever been mean to me. And I just lashed out. And then, like you said, when he saw Carol Erickson, he later said to a psychiatrist, I pictured my mother. You know, I don't know. The guy is definitely screwed up. He's definitely, I don't know. I don't know if he's a psychopath, but he's got psychological issues. I'm sure his upbringing was not great. That's not an excuse to kill somebody, of course. And now his statements are probably more self-serving because at one point he said, I didn't know the difference between right and wrong, which conveniently happens to be the definition of legal insanity as opposed to medical insanity. Yeah. You can be medically insane and legally sane and go to prison for your acts, but I don't think he's insane. He's not psychotic. He didn't hear voices or any of that stuff. And I think some of it's maybe, him trying to justify it to himself or whatever. I mean, he's never getting out of prison. I mean, it's not like you're going to say, oh yeah, you shouldn't have been there. You can go home. No, he's never going to prison. He was sentenced to 4 consecutive life terms. So he'll never get out. But, you know, they actually sought the death penalty, but the jury did not return the death penalty for him.
Wow. That's quite a story. Did you get a chance to talk to him at all?
You know, I didn't, only because shortly after I got all this information, the sheriff's office, who we deal with all the time, have a couple of, found female remains from up in that area for about that time. And I was talking to one of them. I said, you know who Gary Jean Grant is? And they go, no. I said, he was a serial killer working in that area in the 60s and 70s, and your agency investigated. You're kidding me. So I sent them the stuff, and they were going to go over and talk to him, so I didn't want to interfere or get in the middle of that. I want them to be able to talk to him cleanly. I don't know. Again, I have no idea if he had anything to do with these other two other female skeletal remains they found kind of generally in that area from about that time. So, and they were going to go talk to him, and since they were, I wasn't going to do it. If they weren't, I probably would have gone over, at least tried to go over and talk to him. But he's in Walla Walla, the other side of the state for me, 270 miles away. So it's not like he's right here, but I would have taken the trip over there to talk to him.
Yeah. Wow. Well, we look forward to that book. Always good. Now, you're still doing the cold case files and stuff like that in Washington, are you?
Yeah, I work for the Washington State Attorney General's Office Homicide Investigation Tracking System. Like I said, I'm the chief of that. And like we track all murders in Washington, Oregon, and Montana in our database, but we also will break down cases for agencies, especially small agencies that might have a case and don't know what to do, and they'll call, can we send you the case and you can go over it, and several of us will independently read this, get together and make a report of suggestions and send that over. I'm also involved in it nationally in the American Investigative Society of Cold Cases. I'm the director of investigations consulting for that. And that's a national nonprofit, and we do the same thing for any agency in the United States who send us cases. And we have investigators, we have DNA experts, we have psychiatrists, psychologists, we have voice pattern recognition people. We have everything like that. And so then they'll send a whole case, and we'll go over it and then write a big report. That's we get them all over the country for that, but that's something I do on the side pro bono. It's not what I do for a living.
How many cases are you getting a year in Washington State, roughly?
As far as murders total?
Yeah.
I can tell you the exact number. If I had known that in advance, I could have my analyst run the thing for me. But I'd guess in the entire state, maybe 90 or 100, I'm thinking. There's not a lot. Like I always tell people about this area, yeah. There isn't a lot of quantity, but there's a lot of quality. You know, we don't have, like Baltimore, just smaller than Seattle, but has 350 murders or something a year. You know, because they have a lot of, you know, gangbang murders and stuff. And that does happen in Seattle, right. But not at that level. And we have the weird murders, the serial killer stuff, or the sort of thinking of the, I'm trying to think of the weird show that was filmed there years ago. The woman with the fire log, but it's that kind of weird stuff.
Not the mainstream stuff.
Yeah. I mean, there is mainstream stuff. There's regular stuff. But there's a lot of weird stuff that happens here, and I don't know if it's the water or what.
Yeah.
It's the weird, kinky homicide stuff.
Yeah. And so cold cases, they come up because they haven't been solved. What kind of solve rate do we have for these kind of murders?
Well, lately, I mean, in the last, I tell people all the time, in the last 18 months, there has been more advancement to help solve these cases than in the previous 20 years. It just is continuous. We're just left and right, you're hearing these cold cases arrested because of things like genealogy, familial DNA, which, by the way, they don't do in my state, which is a big bone of contention. That's where you put the name and the DNA sample in CODIS, which is the national index, and it doesn't pop up. But this guy pops up. He's got a lot of similar markers. This guy's a close relative. You know, so you look at him, and who's his relatives that could be this guy, and you follow those up, and that's how you find people. And it's good. You know, California, as screwed up as California is, they've been doing it for 11 years. They've made a lot of great, great arrests in both rapes and murders. But genealogy and doing genetic, forensic genetics and things like that, that's huge, because they're able to, you know, just knock cases out. I was talking before down the air about a case locally here, a 25-year case where a little 16-year-old girl was found murdered in high school on a Saturday morning, and it was a big case in the area. They just made the arrest like a couple weeks ago because it's for genetics. And you see it nationally all the time. It started with the Golden State case. The Golden State Killer was the first big national one, but we had a case in Snohomish County, which is just north of Seattle, that was solved that way, and it was the first one to go to trial for the conviction of this guy that killed two teenagers, Canadians, that were down to pick up parts for their dad and end up missing the guy. They were both found murdered in different spots, and the girl was raped and murdered. The guy was beaten and murdered and shot. And that went to trial a couple months ago. It was the first one where a genetics was involved to go to trial. Although, I tell people all the time, the genetics is not evidence. So it isn't really discussed that much in trial, because that's not your evidence. Your evidence is when you finally find the guy and go down and swab his cheek and have it directly compared to the DNA you have. That's the evidence. The genetics only tells you, look at this guy, or look at these groups of guys, it's one of them. It's like somebody else, it's no different than an informant calling you and says, yeah, this guy's talking about killing it. You go talk to him, you get the DNA, and it matches. It's no different. It's just a scientific equivalent, because it's not evidence in and of itself. It's just a lead. And that's what people don't understand. How will this pass in court? Well, it doesn't have to pass in court, because you're not introducing that evidence in court. The only evidence you're introducing is when you went and finally got him, you do a verification swab of his buccal cells, and you have that compared directly to the evidence, that's your evidence. It's not the genetics. That's just the lead. That's what got you there.
Oh, that's pretty interesting. Wow. So how much access do you have to this kind of DNA with the cold case files?
Well, you do. I mean, you have to do it through private lab. So, you know, there are several. Distributed Parabon was pretty much the only one in town, but now Bode does it, and DNA Solutions, and there's lots of labs that'll do it. And that's good because they have competitive pricing, so you can get a better deal. And then you know, they have a menu. If you want this done, you want this done, you know, and each batch costs this much. And it's, you know, it's not a ton of money. I mean, you know, a few thousand bucks. To a small agency, that can be a lot, but there are ways to get money for that, you know, and so it's just, and how much do you want to solve the case, right?
Yeah.
You want to spend $4,500 and solve this cold case? $4,500 is nothing. You know, you paid the detectives working this case hundreds of thousands of dollars over the years with $4,500, right? Pay it and get the thing done. You know, and that's assuming that the sample is in there. You may do it and there's no sample that matches in there. But maybe a week from now or a month from now, one of this guy's relatives will have, you know, send in the DNA kit and their name will pop up. So you have to actually, what it does, genealogy, it tells you that this person, the donor of the DNA that was sent to the company, is a relative of your donor of the evidence. Now, they only usually go back to like second cousin or something like that. They have a score. They score it on a sheet. And it has to be a certain number of score before they'll count it as potential. Well, then a genealogist looks at that and they start following birth and death records, marriage records, and all these things. And they like, we'll presume this 95% of the time it's a male, right, that does these murders. So you'll go, it has to be a male. And who are the males in this guy's family? And they'll trace this down and trace that down. And usually end up with, okay, it's one of these four people. And so then the detective has to do the work. The detective goes, okay, how can I eliminate any of these four as being the person? Was he in jail at the time? Do we know he was somewhere else in the world at the time? If not, then they have to go find these people. And usually, either you can ask them for a DNA sample, but usually what happens is they get a surreptitious DNA sample by following the person around. There was a case in Minnesota where a woman was murdered in her, you know, back in the 80s, I think. And they identified this guy, a potential, as this soccer dad, suburban guy. I mean, excuse me, hockey dad, suburban guy, right? So they started following him around. He went to a hockey game on some Saturday afternoon, and he has a food, and he wiped his mouth with a napkin and threw it in the garbage. They came right behind, picked up the napkin, had it tested, and they go, that's your guy. At that point, you know for sure it's the guy, right? He's an exact match. So then you arrest the guy, you get a warrant, you get another cheek swab to verify right in front of you that this is the guy, and then you have that, and then that's the one that's the evidence. The final cheek swab you do after you've already identified it. And then they confirm, yes, this is the guy. There was huge probability numbers, you know. When I was working, they were 1 in 54 quintillion, which, you know, was a huge number. 54 with 18 zeros after it, but the numbers now are 54 to the 50th power because they do the 21 loci instead of just 12 or 13. And that's your guy. I mean, there aren't that many people that have ever lived on the planet Earth in the history of the world. So that's a pretty good bet.
Yeah. How many cold cases do you get to solve a year?
Well, again, my job now, I don't solve them. We make recommendations and send it back to the agency. And it's up to them to follow those things. And sometimes, they, you know, we did some work for that case I was talking about, the 25-year-old murder. We didn't do the heavy lifting, but we did some work for them. But because that was a big agency, they had plenty of people on their own. But, you know, I don't know. So I can't tell you a for sure answer. I know they send us issues. We say, you need to do this, 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 and we send it back to them. And then it's up to them to do the work. Although we're talking about potentially, you know, it's in the works now to potentially create an actual cold case investigation unit here where we will send people actually out to help them with the actual legwork. We don't do that right now, but we may in the next year or two. And that's in the works. Because a lot of these agencies, you know, they're so busy. You might have an agency that has three detectives, right?
Yeah.
And they're so busy with their incoming cases, they don't have time to do the, I'm not talking about murders, because they do everything, right? When you have a department with three or four detectives, they're generalists. They do everything from murder to shoplift. So they're so busy with the other stuff, they don't have time to necessarily stop and go do this stuff. So that's why it would be good if we had people that could go out and actually do hands-on, help them do the work for them, or with them, and make these things move a lot faster. But again, just because I tell you what to do, if you don't have the time to do it, it's not good, right? You have to find the time. Bigger agencies have dedicated cold case people. Most smaller agencies don't.
Yeah.
So it's not as hard for a bigger agency as it is for a smaller.
Yeah, it's about the money. Chloe, now do you have a website or a place that people can find you and find out about your books?
I do. Yeah, my website, oddly enough, is cloydsteiger.com. That's CLOYDSTEIGER.com. And, of course, I'm on Amazon. I'm on Goodreads. You can Google my name. I'm on there a lot. I do a lot of podcasts, actually, not about my books, but about other things, about, you know, just cold case crime investigations and things like that. I'm on podcasts all the time. So that's where you can find me and find information about my book, Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. The book will be in bookstores also when it comes out. Target carries it, I think.
Yeah. Well, fantastic. We'll have that all linked up to our website so people can go with one click and find you.
Okay.
Thank you for being on.
I'm glad. Thank you for having me on. Yeah.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.